61 in Keene, and 70 right now in Portsmouth. This is NHPR.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. There was a huge sense of satisfaction this week at the nation's space agency, NASA, which celebrated the one-year anniversary of its latest Mars rover, Curiosity. On July 6, 2012, astronomers worldwide held their collective breaths as the car-sized space laboratory touched down on the red planet's Gale crater after an incredibly complicated landing sequence NASA had dubbed 7 minutes of terror. Since then, Curiosity's been on a slow but productive road trip, analyzing rocks and soil, and like any good tourist, taking thousands of pictures. It's also sent lots of tantalizing data back home, possible evidence of a freshwater lake, for example, at a place NASA calls Yellowknife Bay, and measurements of how much radiation future human Mars explorers might face. The rover's ultimate destination is the planet's Mount Sharp. Scientists are especially interested in the base of the mountain, because it looks very Earth-like with buttes and canyons, which could have been carved by water. Today in The Exchange, we'll get curious about Curiosity and a lot more. It's an astronomy update with our sky guys, and we'll also find out about geysers exploding on one of Saturn's moons, also building excitement about what many call the comet of the century, which will swing by the sun and possibly Earth this November. Let's hear from you two. What questions do you have for us sky guys about perhaps what Curiosity has taught us about Mars in its 1 year? Or, as we'll discuss a little later, this comet that we may see this fall. Give us a call. The exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Email us, exchange at nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page. Our sky guys are John Gian Forti, co-founder of the Astronomical Society of Northern New England and an astronomy instructor for Granite State College and UNH. His website is theskyguy.org. And John, it's always nice to see you. Thank you for being here.
My pleasure, Laura.
Also with us, Mal Cameron, retired educator at the McAuliffe-Shepard Discovery Center in Concord. And Mal, welcome back and good to see you, too.
Great to be here.
Well, and gentlemen, let's talk about Curiosity. And I'm sure we talked about this last August when this happened after the 7 minutes of terror, that precarious landing that NASA made. But Mal, to you first, we've seen rovers before. There's been a couple of them scooting around Mars over the last decade or so. Why was this one such a big story?
Well, because it's a big spacecraft. It's about the size of a Mini Cooper, is how they describe it. It weighs a lot. And of course, they had to use a different technique to land it on Mars. If you remember, the previous two, Spirit and Opportunity, when they landed, they wrapped the whole thing up in big airbags and let it just bounce around on the surface. They couldn't do that with this particular one because of its weight. So they used this little sky crane technology where they actually had a spacecraft that was lowering it down and then stopped at a particular altitude and then just kind of unreeled this very heavy spacecraft slowly down to the surface. And when it hit the surface, the spacecraft goes away. And everybody looked at the whole situation and said, "This is nuts. We're not going to do this." But it actually turned out to be very successful. Every single part of the landing worked. And so it spent a year actually cruising around. The difference between the two, the main difference is what powers Curiosity. Curiosity is actually powered by nuclear power. They wanted to get away from, there's some very sophisticated laboratories on board and requires a lot more power to operate those. So they chose the nuclear route because one of the big advantages is without using solar panels as they did on the previous ones, this actually gives it more power, and it's not subject to dust. Mars itself is a very dusty planet. So if you get a lot of dust on the solar panels, that cuts down the amount of power that you can produce. And what you have to hope for is that one of the common dust devils that are appearing on Mars on a regular basis might come across, or a wind might come across and dust them off a little bit. But nobody can go up there and do it for
them. Right. No one's got a feather duster on Mars.
Right.
It's interesting, too, Mal, because we've talked about on this program before other space probes that aren't landing but are flying to all sorts of places in our solar system have successfully used solar power. But you're saying on a dusty place like Mars, solar power is just not a very good idea.
Well, I mean, it is okay. All the probes up until this time have used solar power, and it's very adequate. They have to make an extra boost to the solar panels, make them really efficient to allow for the dust that gets on there. Sometimes you can get more than what you want, too, and there, that limits the amount of science you can do.
So, John Gene Forty, what has Curiosity told us so far about Mars? What are some of the highlights there?
Well, I think the most important thing that it has told us already in the 1 year that it's been on Mars is that Mars was once provided a habitat suitable for life. It doesn't mean that there was life or there is life or that there is not life presently on Mars. But it proved that to scientists and to the general public that billions of years ago, there was an environment that was suitable for life to have arisen and to survive and thrive.
You're saying that with some certainty, John, whereas before it's been possible evidence of maybe life. You know, people have couched it a little bit more.
Well, for NASA's mission at Mars for the past, since the mid-1970s, has been follow the water. Find places on Mars where we think, due to photographs from orbit and then later from landing craft, that water has been. Well, the Curiosity, or the Mars exploration rovers, Spirit and Opportunity, proved to us that both sites were once, that water was both in those sites.
Proved to us. We know.
Yes, we know. The Phoenix lander, which landed in 2007 or 2008, landed in the north polar region of Mars at a latitude of 66, landed right on top of an ice skating rink, just covered with a few centimeters of Martian dust. It was pure water ice. So we now know that not only is there water at the polar regions of Mars, but there's water underneath most of the surface and not miles and kilometers deep, not too far below the surface. So there's lots of water on Mars. It's just that there's no liquid water on the surface. So Curiosity was sent to a very diverse part of Mars. After all this exploring from orbit and on the ground with mobile rovers, it was sent, this site for this particular probe was sent to a place where there was a confluence of different kinds of geology that hinted at the presence of ankle-deep water. And it drilled into rocks and found a very different kind of material than was seen on the surface. One of the problems with Mars today is that it has a thin atmosphere that we think was thicker in the past, that does not have an ozone layer. Therefore, the sun's ultraviolet radiation that emanates from the sun and floods the solar system strikes the surface of Mars and would destroy any organic or complex molecules that might have arisen or assembled on the planet. So previous missions look for organics, which we think is a requirement for life, at least as we understand it.
Organics meaning?
Carbon-based. Mm-hmm. Any molecule with carbon in it could be considered an organic molecule. Carbon, there's lots of reasons that carbon is good. It's capable of making long, complex molecules. When they drilled into a rock, they found material that indicated that there were organics and lots of liquid water in the past and a benign, non-acidic, non-basic habitat for life.
Wow.
In the
well,
past.
That's a big statement, and I want to ask you a couple more questions about that. But let me also remind our listeners that you can join us, too, with your questions or comments. Maybe you want to know a little bit more about Curiosity, which just turned 1 year old this week, and as we're hearing, keeps finding evidence suggesting past water on the red planet. Join us with your comments and questions, 1-800-892-6477. A little bit later, we'll be talking about mysterious geysers on one of Saturn's moons, and something scientists are calling the comet of the century. You can join us with your questions and comments on that as well. The number 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Again, 1-800-892-6477. Mal, jump in on this conversation about evidence of water, carbon, and wild speculation now, or growing speculation, I should say, that Mars was hospitable to life.
Right. And that's important to clarify, is that this particular spacecraft will not detect any life if there is any life, if it finds water in the liquid form, for example. What it's doing is just confirming that the conditions are right, that there at least could be some life there, but it doesn't have the capability to detect it. The other cool thing about Curiosity is that one of the tools it has is a laser. You think about the sci-fi movies where you take a laser gun or a zap gun and zap somebody. This is what this will do. From a distance, it can zap a hole in a rock. And in the last year, it has used that zapper about 75,000 times. What it does is it can zap a piece of the rock, just obliterate it and vaporize it, and then analyze the gas that comes off of it to see what was in it for elements and so on.
Wow. And how do folks at NASA communicate to this rover, which is so far away, and say, okay, Curiosity, please do this now. Please do task X.
Well, they have to really think hard when they do that, because there's obviously a delay time from the signal to get from Earth to the rover and back again to Earth to confirm that it did what it was told to do. It's not like doing a video game where you have your joystick and you just drive and say, oh my goodness, there's a cliff up ahead. Stop! By the time it gets its signal, you're done. It's over the cliff.
So they have to be super careful in making these calculations about where they want to send it and where they don't want to send it.
So most of the time it's just sitting there waiting for the next job. And they analyze and say, okay, there's a rock that's like 3 meters away. And so they'll say, tell it. It's got enough intelligence to say, see that rock right there? I want you to go to it. And then it'll say, go. And it will go.
Well, gentlemen, I have one more question for you about Curiosity. And then I do want to ask you about Enceladus. That's Saturn's moon. John, too bad we don't have a probe down there, because there's a lot going on. We'll take your calls, too, your questions and comments about Curiosity and other items in space science news, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org.
This is NHPR 919. Good morning. Looking for something to do this weekend? Well, look no further than your NHPR member card. With it, you can take advantage of our August benefit of the month, 2-for-1 discount at the Silver Center for the Arts in Plymouth. For more about the member card and the doors it opens for you, visit nhpr.org. Partly to mostly sunny around New Hampshire today. High temperatures, upper 70s, partly cloudy in the evening, then mostly cloudy with scattered showers after midnight. Lows tonight, mid-50s to lower 60s. Support for NHPR comes from UR members, and support also comes to us from Dartmouth Hitchcock Primary Care Doctors and Nurses, who put you at the center of health, 13 locations statewide. More information at d-hdocs.org. And Plymouth State University offering an accredited online MBA program with 8 focus areas, including a new accounting certificate. Registering now for fall term, plymouth.edu/graduate. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, it's an astronomy update with our sky guys, John Gianforte and Mal Cameron. We've been talking about NASA's Mars rover Curiosity turning 1 year old and the many things it has told us about Mars so far. In just a few minutes, we'll talk about mysterious geysers on one of Saturn's moons, and later the comet of the century coming this fall. We'll take your questions and comments on these stories and more, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Again, 1-800-892-6477. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page. And just one or two more questions about Curiosity and Mars, guys, because there has been so much information lately given this one-year birthday. To you, I think, John Gianforte, as we look at the presence of ice and past water and what that says about the probability of life on Mars, is Curiosity helping us figure out whether there was past life or whether there may be current life on Mars.
Well, as Mel indicated a couple of minutes ago, the Curiosity probe is not designed, nor does it have the capability, to detect microbial life. Now, it does have a great set of imaging instruments and cameras, so if a Mars bug walked across a sand dune, it would see it, and we'd say, hey, that's a bug, that's life. We don't expect that,
yeah.
Right? We don't expect that. But what the mission is about is to detect whether or not the chemical ingredients, the water, and was there an energy source. These are three essential elements that astronomers, biologists, and now astrobiologists believe that life needs to arise, to thrive, and to evolve. An energy source, water, and carbon compounds that can form these long, complex molecules like amino acids and proteins.
One of the concerning discoveries that Curiosity has given us, Mal, is that Mars has a lot of radiation, perhaps more than we expected. According to National Geographic, in just the 9-month journey to Mars, Curiosity absorbed more radiation than NASA astronauts are allowed to have over their whole careers. Wow, that doesn't bode well for a manned mission to Mars.
Well, that radiation led to the demise of the Spirit one. Because it zapped Spirit so badly that they actually shut down their computer system on the route to Mars. And then when they fired it back up on the surface of Mars, it had lost some of its capability. And they think that that's why they lost contact with it eventually earlier than, I mean, Curiosity is now going on for, almost 10 years now?
Yes.
And it's still producing power.
Not Curiosity, one of the other ones.
Yeah.
Opportunity.
What are they? I get confused with all this.
Opportunity.
Opportunity. Thank you, John. But Opportunity is still going strong up there. Spirit got into this place where there was a computer glitch that just wouldn't turn it back on again. Mm. So they lost contact with it.
What's happening next? You mentioned a couple of the rovers. Okay, Spirit, Opportunity, now Curiosity. It's 1 year old. What happens? Is it going to go for another year or two or three?
The initial mission of Curiosity is 2 Mars years, and a Mars year is almost 2 of our years. And so it hopefully will that. Am I that right, John? Or is it just 2 of our years? I'm sorry, 2 of our years.
2 Earth years. So it's got one more year to go.
Right. So it's got another year to go. And of course, if it stays successful, like many of the other probes that have been sent out, they'll probably continue it as long as it's going strong.
All right. Well,
there is, but I want to lead back to what John said earlier about the depleting atmosphere around Mars. There's evidence that Mars had a thicker atmosphere a long time ago in its history, and that somehow it, probably because of the cosmic rays and things that are coming from the sun, that it dissipated and became much thinner. So NASA's preparing their next probe, which will be an orbiter. It's called MAVEN, which is another one of those crazy acronyms that NASA likes to put together. It means the Mars Atmosphere and Volatile Evolution spacecraft. And what it's going to do, starting around November 18th is its earliest launch date, but it's going to be an orbiter, and it wants to study this atmosphere from afar just to see what may have happened to it, if they get any clues as to how that atmosphere got to be so thin.
All right. Well, again, your questions and comments are welcome at 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page. And John Gianforte, as I said earlier, boy, it's a shame we don't have a probe down on Saturn's moon, Enceladus. There's a lot going on there. What's happening, John?
Well, this is a tremendously important story. We've been learning a lot about our solar system, and we're finding that keeping in mind that the three essential elements that we think are required for life, carbon-based materials, water, and an energy source, we are now finding that these three essential elements are all over the solar system. It's not just in the warm places on Earth at the tropics where you have a nice, warm 70-degree sunshine. These places that have these three essential elements are plentiful in our solar system. And there's probably seven or eight worlds that have these elements.
Now, worlds or moons.
Worlds or moons. Enceladus, which is a moon, a very small moon of Saturn, only a few hundred miles across, mainly composed of water ice. And, of course, there's dust and rocks mixed in. In 2005, the Cassini spacecraft, which is a NASA mission, a joint effort with the European Space Agency, left Earth in 1997, and it arrived at Saturn in 2004. The very next year, during a close encounter of the moon Enceladus, which is part of its mission, detected plumes, geysers, if you will, blasting out of the south polar region of Enceladus. They've got the name Tiger Stripes because when we look at the fissures or cracks in the ice, they look like stripes of a tiger. And since that time, in fact, Enceladus flew through the geysers three times during 2005.
Flew through the plume of shooting, you know, water, ice, rock, whatever it was.
It came as close to the surface as about 168 kilometers above the surface of Enceladus. And what the spacecraft found was that to an altitude of some 4,000 kilometers, there was enough stuff, water vapor, and impurities, carbon-based stuff like carbon dioxide, nitrogen, oxygen, carbon monoxide, which was completely unexpected. So as far as 4,000 kilometers up, there was still enough of this material for the spacecraft's instruments to detect.
Well, they were lucky that Cassini's instruments weren't jammed by some of the flying stuff, if I could put it that way, dust, rock, whatever.
And since 2005, it has flown through them at even lower altitudes and confirmed the composition of this kind of impure water, if you will. So it's unbelievable. Now, what's driving a moon so cold where the surface temperature is 80 degrees above absolute zero? So there must be a mechanism inside Enceladus.
Wait, 80 degrees above absolute zero? Can you explain that?
Yes, that means it's very, very cold in the Saturn system.
What's absolute zero?
Well, that's the temperature at which all molecular and atomic motion stops.
Oh, it's not regular old zero that most of us know.
No, it's much, much colder than that. So, therefore, what is liquid or water vapor being squirted out of a small moon where no one thought it was big enough to do anything, let alone have some kind of geologic activity, probably the result of Saturn's gravity squishing Enceladus as it orbits Saturn. And as it does that, there's friction with the rocks inside the moon that generates heat. That heat, in turn, can melt perhaps frozen water deep inside the moon. And pressure builds and it bursts through the surface at these tiger stripe areas.
Wow, that's a pretty powerful force, Mal. I mean, given how cold it is out there, that something could remain water even for a fraction of a second is amazing.
Yeah, well, consider that Saturn is the second largest planet in the solar system and it's way beyond Jupiter. It's about a billion miles from the sun, 800 to 900 million miles, somewhere in there. And so when you get out there, everything is cold. And so this is very surprising to find. This adds to the list of potential places to visit. One of them we may talk about later, which is the moon of Jupiter called Europa, which we've known for ever since the Voyager probes was very icy covered. And in the recent Galileo probe that was orbiting around there, the late 90s, they discovered that it's very thin ice and there's a potential that underneath that ice, there's evidence at least that there's probably a huge deep ocean of water.
This is Europa you're talking about.
This is Europa. So that's only about a half a billion miles away.
Downright tropical.
And so when we find one even further away, like Enceladus, that has water on it, that gets on the let's go visit it list at some point, I'm sure.
Let's go meaning boots on the ground?
No, I don't think
so. We're sending a
probe
down like...
But at least a probe to investigate it some more. It is this big elliptical orbit that goes around it, and it's as John was alluding to, it, at one point in its orbit, it gets very close to Saturn, and then on the opposite side of Saturn, it's further away. So it's squeezing it like a piece of putty, perhaps, and that builds up the heat and generates these geysers.
That's a powerful force, again.
Right. It's also thought that the material that comes from there, these ice particles, actually contribute to part of the ring system around Saturn as well.
One more time, that exchange number for you to join us with our astronomy update is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page. The number, 1-800-892-6477. So, John Gianforte, speaking of Europa, since Mal brought it up, there's a brand new movie released just a couple weeks ago called Europa Report. Now, this is fiction, but from what I've heard, there's a lot of fact in there.
Well, it's a very exciting movie. It takes us on a mission to Europa, not a robotic mission, but a human mission, with a mixed crew of men and women from different countries. There's even a couple of Americans thrown in on the mission. It's a very entertaining movie.
Is it a Hollywood movie? Is it a NASA movie? Is it a movie that some, you know, space geeks at a university put out?
Well, I don't know if it was produced in Hollywood, but it's designed for the general public, and I believe it was released on the 2nd of August, just last week. But it is there's no big name actors in it, but the story is very compelling, especially if anyone has any interest in real science or science fiction. It's a great story. I wouldn't say that it's an extremely technically accurate movie, but it does depict what we think from previous spacecraft visits to the Jupiter system of the terrain, what it might be like. And I thought they did an excellent job with some of the imagery taken from the Voyager and the Galileo spacecraft, which were astoundingly high in resolution that allowed us to see snowbanks and cracks in the ice and places in Europa's very thin water ice crust where salt water that has been recently confirmed, magnesium salts, have oozed up from cracks in the ice, spread out over the surface, and stained the white water ice surface a brownish-orange color. And astronomers at the Keck Observatory on the Big Island of Hawaii have confirmed that these are magnesium salts that have found their way to the surface. So there's something going on at Europa, and this movie simply explores that.
Well, I want to ask you another question about it, but let's also get our listeners involved. The number here in the exchange, 1-800-892-6477. Join us with your questions and comments about some of the stories we're looking at this hour. And first up is Rick and Troy. Hi, Rick. You're on the air. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
My question is, I appreciate that the missions that have been underway over the years, Mars in particular, are in pursuit of particular information, the water issue, for example. And my question is a general one. What larger questions are these efforts in pursuit of answering? And if there are no larger, either scientific or philosophical questions, are we simply looking for information to see what other questions there may be?
Rick, speaking of questions, this is a great one. And I know both of you want to jump in on that. I'll turn to you first, John, but Mal, definitely want to hear from you, you too.
It's a question that we ask ourselves, Rick, about what to talk about on the show. We always ask ourselves, so what? So what about this mission? So what? It's a very important question because we're spending our hard-earned money on these missions. Probably the most fundamental question that most of the missions, most, not all, but most of them are trying to find answers to is the situation that arose on the Earth with life arising some 4 billion years ago and evolving over time to what we see now, is that unique or is it common? Are we alone? And I don't mean, are there aliens with ray guns waiting to take over the Earth? This is microbial life. Remember, in the outer solar system, it's cold. Chemistry proceeds very, very slowly. So no one expects little critters walking around. But the overall fundamental question is, has the conditions for life been deposited or evolved on other planets to the point where life had evolved there? Are we alone? Is the Earth, in all of the universe that we can see, is it the only place in the cosmos where chemistry has taken charge and life has arisen? That's the fundamental question that the search for water, the search for carbon compounds, all this is designed to answer the question, are we alone?
Well, it's a great question, Rick. What comes up for you,
I'm just thinking of Carl Sagan type thing. If he ever found that after all our investigations and other worlds, and the more we find out about other worlds, and we find out that there is no life like us there, intelligent life perhaps, that really would be a profound thing to find out. But if we do find life, that's also very profound. But in extension of that, just some of these probes like we're doing, for example, I mentioned the MAVEN probe that we're going to be launching in the fall.
For Mars's atmosphere.
For Mars' atmosphere. Why study Mars' atmosphere? Well, because that could affect what we're doing here. If we know what has caused Mars' atmosphere to dissipate, that could be dangerous if the same forces happen here. And so we need to look at what we're doing here on Earth, or we could become another Mars.
That's a really good point, because we learn more about the Earth by studying other planets. And in fact, it was Sagan that did work early in his academic career that discovered on Venus and Mars the effects that we now know of as nuclear winter and the greenhouse effect. Venus, the second planet out from the sun, has a surface temperature of some 874 degrees Fahrenheit, hot enough to melt lead and tin. If the Earth were placed, simply moved closer to the sun, where Venus is, its surface temperature would only be about 125 degrees. And it's so hot on Venus because its atmosphere has evolved differently. Why could that happen on Earth? Earth is not a stagnant place. It's dynamic, and we need to know which way it's going.
Well, and Rick, I appreciate the point because, Mal, this comes up every year when NASA's budget is reviewed. Why are we doing this? Why bother?
Well, the other thing about NASA's budget is everybody complains, we're spending all this money from NASA. They're getting all this money to send these billion-dollar probes out. NASA's budget total is less than 1% of the entire national budget. I'd much rather ask, where's the rest of it going?
All right. Well, Rick, thank you very much for calling in. The number for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Back in a minute.
This is NHPR 939. Good morning.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, assessing new terrorist threats from Al-Qaeda, then America's changing suburbs, all coming up on the Diane Rehm Show.
The Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 till noon on NHPR. New Hampshire weather partly to mostly sunny for today, high temperatures in the 70s. Support for NHPR comes from UR members and from the NEEF Network Organizations, a statewide leader assisting students and parents planning for college. Information at nhheaf.org. And from Brattleboro Retreat, helping people find the strength to overcome mental health addiction challenges since 1834. Learn more at brattlebororetreat.org. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow in The Exchange, are local New Hampshire police becoming militarized, or are they just responding to rising threats? Email us your thoughts before the program at nhpr.org, and be sure to join us tomorrow morning live at 9. Today in The Exchange, our Sky Guys are here, and we're talking about some of the latest headlines from space science. We've talked a lot about NASA's Mars rover Curiosity turning 1 year old, all it's taught us about possibly past life on the red planet. We've also talked about mysterious geysers on Saturn's moons. You can join us with your questions and comments about that. And in a few minutes, we'll talk about the coming of the comet of the century. The number 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. And gentlemen, let's go to John waiting in Warner. Hi, John. You're on the air. Go ahead.
morning. Thanks for giving me. My questions are all related to the rings of Saturn. I'm wondering if anybody has any good data on their age, their origin, what their composition is, and how long they're expected to last.
You know, thank you for calling, because we just talked about that, John, right, in terms of the geysers coming off of one of Saturn's moons. And some people think the stuff coming out of those geysers may have contributed to the rings.
Yes, it's a great question, very pertinent. Saturn's rings are mostly water ice. The average size of those particles is about 10 centimeters, but that leaves us some pieces as big as a house and many, many pieces very, very small, almost microscopic. So there's a whole wide range of size. So it's mainly water ice, some dust. The E-ring is a very thin outer ring where Enceladus's water vapor is accumulating in this ring. And it's contributing many of the Saturn's rings. It's more like a phonograph record. If you've ever looked at an old phonograph record in the light, you can see the grooves. Well, that's what the ring system of Saturn is like. It's individual ringlets all at a different distance from the planet, all but blended together to look like one system. So the rings are very thin. They're only about 800 feet thick. It's the brightest ring system in the solar system. In fact, the four outer gas giant planets, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune, all have ring systems, but Saturn is the most spectacular.
Well, thanks for the question, John. And again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. I want to finish up a conversation that we started a few minutes ago, and that was talking about Europa. This is Jupiter's moon, which has excited astronomers for a long time because of the known presence of ice. We talked about the movie that's coming, Europa Report. John, you've seen it. Mal, have you seen it?
No.
Again, this is the fictionalized account of astronauts actually going to Europa.
Right. I've looked at the trailer for it. It looks like it's a very exciting thing. What I understand about it is that it's supposed to be on the style of like Blair Witch movie that came out that supposedly found video, and it's based on video cameras that supposedly were on the spacesuits and embedded inside a spacecraft.
I see. So
I guess somewhere
style.
They find about it. Is this right, John?
I'm not telling you.
You're not telling? I want to know. Did the butler do it? I don't know.
Go see the movie.
Oh, so there's
it's really good.
A mystery to be solved.
I guess so. It looks like it's... I hear it's billed as kind of a horror story of sorts in space.
Well,
is that true?
Well,
can you tell me that part?
I can't. I'm not telling you anything.
Okay.
I'm not telling you. You're going to have to go see the movie yourself.
There's a trailer that we've put up on our website, by the way, if we've piqued your curiosity.
Right.
Again, nhpr.org is the website. And as you said, John, it's already played at New York City's American Museum of Natural History. Coming to Concord, coming to Boston, coming to Manchester, Portsmouth, Keene, somewhere.
I hope so. I think it would have some good... it would perform well, I think, in studios. It is a good science fiction movie, and it's exciting. I'll give you that, Mal. It's very exciting.
Okay.
There are some really tense moments, and you can expect that. But it does keep you on the edge of your seat, for sure.
All right. Well, again, the number here in the exchange, 1-800-892-6477. A link to a trailer for that movie, Europa Report, is on our website, as I said. And Mal, I have to ask you this. Lots of headlines about the comet of the century named ISON. Speaking of exciting movies, another one of those NASA acronyms, maybe. I'm not sure.
Right.
Isn't it a little early, though, in the century, Mal, to be calling anything the fill-in-the-blank of the century?
Actually, you put a comma and say so far, I guess,
right,
at the end of that. But how do they know what's going to be coming? But this was a comet that was actually, it's an interesting name because it is an acronym that stands for the International Scientific Optical Network. It's a group of 10 observatories or a bunch of observatories in 10 different countries. And this particular, the main observatory they use was one located in Russia. And it was discovered looking at the data from that telescope, these two Russian people found it. Now, the normal way that we know of naming a comet is that if If you, Laura, went out and found a comet for the first time, it would be called Comet Kanoi.
Yeah, but that's why they have all these cool names like Kale Bop.
That has a nice ring to it, though.
It does. Yes. But I'm thinking this was found by two guys, Vitaly Netsky and Artyom Novichonok.
Yeah. Wow.
So imagine calling it the Netsky Novichonok Comet.
I think I saw it.
I like that.
Why are they calling it the comet of the century?
Well, this is a new comet that they think is the first time it got knocked into the inner solar system from way out in space in an area that we call the Oort cloud, which is way out there. It's almost a light year distance away, this big cloud of tenuous icy material that sometimes gives us these great comets. So this being the first time it came through, that means it's totally intact. It has not been disturbed in past runs through the solar system. They say that it right now we know that it has a nucleus is about 3 to 4 miles in diameter, so a very icy chunk. But the real cross your fingers part is that as it comes into the inner solar system, it's going to be what's called a sun grazer. It's going to do a very tight loop around the sun and then head back out into space. And that could be, that's the iffy part. If it survives, it's going to be approaching the sun at about 700,000 miles above the sun. Now, that may sound like, well, that doesn't sound too far, but the sun itself is a lot bigger than that. That's like almost half the sun's diameter, if that. So it's very close, and that means it's going to be flying into the corona of the sun, picking up all the energy and the bad stuff coming up in the heat. So the hope is that it will survive that intact. And if that happens, yes, this is going to be a very spectacular comet. In fact, the prediction is it could be as bright as the full moon would be.
Wow.
And also it would be one that we could potentially see in the daytime.
That's amazing, if it survives.
If,
and from what I understand,
that's a big if.
Right. John?
I'm so glad you went to Mal first after calling it the comet of the century. Because astronomers over the years have repeatedly got black eyes and other bruises.
Hyperbole.
Yes, by saying this is the comet of the century and it's going to be brighter than the full moon. There is no doubt in astronomers' minds that when the comet makes its closest approach to the sun on the 28th of November, while we're eating our Thanksgiving dinner, it will be brighter. It could be as bright as the full moon. Unfortunately, when the comet makes its closest approach to the sun on that day, we won't be able to see it because the brightness of the sun will block it out. But, as Mal said, if it survives the gravitational tides that it will endure as it approaches so close to the sun, if it survives that and manages to hold itself together without being obliterated by the sun's strong gravity, the weeks after Thanksgiving, on until the first few weeks of 2014, when the comet is actually in the nice dark part of the sky up near the Little Dipper, great, perfectly placed for northern hemisphere observers, it could be a comet that is, well, easily visible to the naked eye with a nice long tail. But we don't know. It's a newcomer to the solar system, and we just don't know. Comets are notoriously unpredictable.
Yeah. Well, we'll keep our fingers crossed for that one, for sure, because that would be cool to see. You know, gentlemen, we've talked about some successes lately, the Curiosity rover again, finding out about all this cool stuff on Mars, and Cassini bringing back this amazing data about the moon of Saturn. But, John, little bad news also over at NASA. Kepler's mission to find extrasolar planets. I know you're our extrasolar planet expert, extrasolar meaning planets outside our solar system. As I understand, Kepler's run into a little trouble lately. Now, before we go into that, just remind us real quick, what's Kepler? How successful has it been?
It's a very, very successful mission. It has achieved its main lifetime. It was launched in March of 2009 to look for planets orbiting other stars. Actually, it was designed to detect Earth-sized planets orbiting other stars other than the sun. And it has developed and found more than 3,000 candidates, and 120 of those candidates have been confirmed as planets. And the way it does that is it observes about 150,000 stars simultaneously, and it looks for the light output of the stars to diminish when one of the star's planets eclipses or transits across the disk of the star. Now, it's only a very, very small degradation of the light from the star as the planet eclipses it. But Kepler's instruments are very accurate. It uses electronic sensors that are much more sensitive than the human eye or even a big telescope, and it can detect very minute drops in light. And it can, and it's found many planets this way, including some even smaller than the Earth. And when you study a planet as it moves across its parent star, it gives astronomers a chance to actually study the atmosphere, what the atmosphere of that planet, if it has one, is made out of.
And whether it's rocky or a gas giant. And I mean, they can determine some pretty amazing things from very far away.
They can. And using the different methods available to astronomers to detect these planets, they can determine its mass, its orbital period around the planet, its density, and its size. So we can determine a lot. Now we can even start to interrogate the atmosphere. What are these atmospheric constituents of these distant planets?
How distant are they, picking up on what John said, Mal? I mean, I know there's a whole bunch of them, but are we talking, you know, relatively close or just ridiculously far or what?
Well, I'm not sure of the exact distances, but I can tell you that the spacecraft itself is looking at an area of the sky near what we call the summer triangle, which you would find up in the sky this time of year, in the area near Cygnus the Swan.
Summer triangle of the Milky Way galaxy?
Of our galaxy, looking up at the sky. In fact, the Milky Way goes right through it. But there's millions of stars in this little area of the sky they're looking at, but they're concentrating at simultaneously at about 150,000 stars they can monitor simultaneously. And they're all varying distances from us. Some are closer, some are further away.
Sure.
So it's a clump of stars, and they're able to detect these things. Now, as John said, they've got over 3,000 stars that they've looks like there are planets going around them, and they expect from all right, John knows what is. What did you say? tens of light years anyway to thousands of light years away is where they are. But one of the things about it is that this is confirming after finding all these planets going around other stars, it makes us very closer to the idea that we'll find Earth-like planets. And I was at a presentation a few weeks ago by a NASA scientist who works with Kepler, and she was saying that to give you an idea of where they think the nearest star with an Earth-like planet around it could be is imagine shrinking down the entire galaxy to the size of the United States. And on that scale, if you were standing on one end of Central Park in New York, the nearest star with a Earth-like planet around it would be, at that scale, the other end of Central Park.
So not as far away as Texas or anything like that?
No.
Still, ridiculously far to think about ever traveling there.
Even on that scale.
I mean, I appreciate the analogy.
No, we wouldn't travel there, that's for sure.
But to possibly examine more easily.
You might, depending on how many light years away it is. If it's thousands of light years away, then that would be kind of a moot point. But just to know that there was a planet there that, as John said, many instruments that we use to detect the atmosphere of the planet and what's there, and we could tell that it would be capable of having life.
Well, and talking about, again, the remote possibility of even thinking about going to some of these places. Mal, there was some news recently about the extreme difficulty of living and working in space. Really makes you appreciate Earth. There was the astronaut who was on a spacewalk, a routine spacewalk, and water started leaking inside his helmet, almost drowned him. And then NASA released a video about just how tiny pieces of skin and hair that just naturally fall off of all of us.
Mm-hmm.
can cause real trouble in space. We have a link, actually, to a really kind of amusing and a little bit gross website on that.
Yeah,
but go ahead.
Be prepared to prepare yourself before you watch it. But yeah, it's really interesting to realize that no matter what you do in space, it's essentially no gravity. We have little bits of old skin that fall off of us on a regular basis, but it falls to the floor or the ground or whatever. In space, all that will float. And you have to be very careful. When you remove a sock, for example, try to do it near a vacuum source that will vacuum all that stuff away. That could be dangerous and not very healthy otherwise if you inhale it or whatever.
And clog up the vents and so forth
right.
in your craft. Well, again, nhpr.org if folks are interested. It is pretty interesting. And we also have at nhpr.org, John G. and 40, I have not forgotten a link to another event that you're helping to organize for astronomers here in New England. Tell us a little bit more about that.
Well, the New England Fall Astronomy Festival will be held at the University of New Hampshire's Observatory. Physics Department at UNH operates an observatory on the west end of campus. The festival will take place on Friday and Saturday, the 13th and 14th of September. Noted author Dava Sobel will be kicking off our event on Friday evening at about 7:15 with a talk about her new book, How Copernicus Revolutionized the Cosmos. She'll spend the entire weekend with us interacting with students and guests. There's no fee for the festival. We're welcoming anyone with students or just with a general interest in space and science to come join us for a weekend event.
All right. NHPR.org is where you can find out more. And I will just super quickly say here, guys, Perseid meteor shower is coming up August 11th and 12th. So something else to look forward to. Thank you very much for being here. Really appreciate it.
Our pleasure.
Thanks, Laura.
Our Sky Guys, Mal Cameron and John G. and 40. The Exchange is a production of NHPR.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed any part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org.
I'm Laura Kanoy, and tomorrow on The Exchange, the tussle over police tactics. More New Hampshire police departments have been acquiring the controversial armored truck called the Bearcat, causing outrage among groups concerned about civil liberties and what they see as militarized local police forces. But officers say they increasingly face deadly threats and that these methods help protect them and the public. Email us at nhpr.org and join us for The Exchange tomorrow morning live at 9 and again at 8 p.m. on NHPR.
The Diane Rehm Show, next at 10 on NHPR, where we get support from UR members. Support also comes to us from Bedford Falls Assisted Living and Memory Care Community. Warm and inviting with services provided by caregivers who love what they do. To schedule tours, visit bedfordfallsassistedliving.com. And the Colonial Theater in Bethlehem presenting Elegante Collective, Thursday, August 8th at 8, performing New World music from South America. Tickets at bethlehemcolonial.org.
These are the stations of New Hampshire Public Radio.
WEVO Concord, 89.1.
WEVS Nashua, 88.3.
WEVH Hanover, 91.3.
WEVN Keene, 90.7.
WEVC Gorham, 107.1.
WEVJ Jackson, 99.5.
WEVF Colebrook, 90.3.
And WEVQ Littleton, 91.9.
And online at nhpr.org.
Good morning, it's 10 o'clock.
From WAMU and NPR in Washington, I'm Diane Rehm. Officials in Yemen say they foiled a major terrorist plot to blow up pipelines and seize ports in their country. U.S. drone strikes killed 7 suspected al-Qaeda members yesterday in Yemen. This comes after U.S. authorities warned